This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. It's great to have you with us. I'm Bonnie North. More than 2 million people are currently imprisoned in the United States. Although this country has just 4% of the world's population, it accounts for a quarter of the world's prison population. So how did we get here? People point to different pieces of legislation as the main cause for mass incarceration. But researcher Reggie Jackson says it's the result of a complex web of laws and policy decisions that have created this issue. Jackson will give a presentation about the history of mass incarceration tomorrow night at the Shorewood Village Center. But first, he joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about the roots of the problem.
We have to go back to the 1960s, the policies under President Kennedy, President Johnson, and also President Nixon that kind of put the building blocks in place for us to create this massive carceral state that we have right now. And these are things that people just aren't aware of. There's been a lot of work and conversations about mass incarceration. I want people to know more about how the system developed over the course of time, the building blocks to it.
So what were some of the policies coming out of, I think the oldest one you mentioned there was the Kennedy administration, that really gets the ball rolling?
President Kennedy, very early in 1961, started to attack the issue of what was called at that time juvenile delinquency. And so he put pieces in place to begin to involve the police in dealing with so-called juvenile delinquency. And that was really the beginning of creating kind of a space where we adjudicated young people in a way that led to them having a criminal justice record. And then typically people who have contact with the police early on in their lives, who are arrested early on, they're much more likely to end up in prison as adults. And so that was kind of the beginning of the process, this attack on juvenile delinquency that President Kennedy started in 1961.
When we look at juvenile delinquency in particular, you know, we've started to talk about the school-to-prison pipeline, that kids inside of classrooms will get tickets and end up in the juvenile justice system.
Yeah, you know, people think that it's something recent, but it really isn't recent. This is something that started many years ago and developed, laws developed on a federal level and then state levels to really began to create a system that created the school-to-prison pipeline. There was a law in 1974, the Juvenile Justice Act, in 1974 that really played a really important role, because what it did was it began to create a larger database of so-called juvenile delinquency, and it also put procedures in place not only in our criminal justice system but also in the social network of organizations that were supposed to be there to help people who were dealing with things. And what they did is they intentionally began to collect data on young people who had any contact with the police, whether they were arrested or not. And they created these large databases, and they used those databases and called these young people delinquents, and they started to arrest them for very minor things. But what changed, though, is that there were juvenile delinquents who were black, there were juvenile delinquents who were whites. And what happens is they began to offer these young whites access to programming to help them overcome whatever difficulties they were having, and then began to call them just simply troublesome children, whereas the black children ended up being locked up in juvenile facilities. We started to build juvenile prisons around the country in the mid-1970s, and the majority of the people that ended up in those juvenile prisons were black, and whites simply just didn't get sent to those places in large numbers.
Was there, and this is always something that's difficult to really track, but was there a specific policy that said white children go into these kinds of programs, or was it just that white kids live in certain areas which would then offer those programs, or what was the situation?
Well, there was a law called the Juvenile Delinquency Prevention Act of 1974, and what it did was it put in place policies and practices to help communities deal with juvenile delinquency. And they offered alternatives. They offered programming for kids. You know, they would give them job training programs. They would teach them how to do resumes. They would get them in vocational programs, things like that. And then they would also help their families if they were dealing with, you know, issues, you know, for instance, if families are unemployed and things of that nature. And so those are some of the things that were kind of said publicly. But privately, what ends up happening is that they didn't really allow those programs to be developed and used in black communities. Most of the monies for those programs ended up going to rural communities, which was to white kids who were having these difficulties. And they intentionally defunded those programs in big cities where black kids were having the same types of issues. And so it was really policy decisions about how to implement the program that led directly to black and Hispanic children in particular being the main ones who would end up being sent to prison and jail instead of white kids.
You know, we talked about the fact that a lot of children who end up in these systems also end up in the adult prison population. And as we look at, similarly, the evolution of these policies, how did that track? You know, going from the Kennedy administration moving forward, what are some of the other policies we see?
So Kennedy started, you know, this attack on juvenile delinquency. And then President Johnson started what he called a war on crime. President Nixon continued that war on crime, and then he started a war on drugs that was kind of continued under presidents after that. President Carter really didn't do a whole lot as president around these issues, but President Ronald Reagan really, you know, issued this dramatic call for a war on drugs. And so, you know, it was over the course of a lot of different people who were president, even President Ford. President Ford played a really, really big role in creating the mechanism that led to mass incarceration as well. So as we look back on it, and most Americans aren't aware because, you know, we like to look back in the past and point fingers at specific people, but I tell people that it was Republicans as well as Democrats who were in the White House, Republicans and Democrats who were in Congress, who all created these laws on the federal level, and then the same thing on the state level. Republicans and Democrats all played a role in it. You know, there's been a lot of conversation recently about the crime bill of 1994, people being chastised for signing that, and they're now apologizing and all those things. But at the time, you know, they weren't about to apologize for what they were doing. I actually looked up that bill, which was a House bill in 1994, to see who voted yes for that bill, representatives from the state of Wisconsin who were in Congress. And what I discovered was that every Democrat in Wisconsin voted yes for that bill in 1994, everyone, and every Republican voted against it. So, you know, this whole pushback, the Republicans blaming the Democrats blaming the Republicans, everybody in some way, shape, or form was responsible for certain things that happened. And we don't realize that it took a really long time to create the system. It wasn't just something that happened because Ronald Reagan said we're going to have a war on drugs in, you know, the early 1980s. There were building blocks that were set up before that. I argue this point, Joy, is that you can't fight a war on drugs unless you build an army first. And we had to set up the mechanism to create all of the ways to fund police, court systems, prison building. All of those things took place over a pretty extended period of time. And most people just aren't aware of that history.
When we talk about especially the 94 crime bill, I think a lot of people get stuck on this concept of super predators. Mm-hmm. But when you really start to untangle kind of the web of the war on crime or the war on drugs, these are ultimately a war on people. People mm-hmm. commit crimes. Mm-hmm. People do drugs or sell drugs. You talked about the kinds of mechanisms that were set up. Mm-hmm. What do those look like for the war on crime?
Well, you know, interestingly enough, when President Johnson issued this war on crime, one of the things that made it possible was a piece of legislation that most Americans have never heard of. To me, the most important legislation that led to mass incarceration was the creation and the signing of a bill in 1965 called the Law Enforcement Assistance Act. And what that bill did was it changed the way law enforcement worked in the country permanently. What it did was, for the first time in American history, it allowed the federal government to be able to work in collaboration with local and state law enforcement. Prior to that, there had never been any collaboration. So it basically opened the door for the federal government to be able to give funds to states and local communities for law enforcement to pay for more police officers, to pay for, you know, hardware for the police officers, to pay for building prisons. That was really the turning point in how we did criminal justice. And one of the things that came out of that, if you look at who was in prison in 1950 versus who was in prison in 1970, you know, people talked a lot about the crime rate increasing through the 50s and 60s, right? But what you find, if you look at the data, is that the number of people in prison actually dropped from 1950 to 1970 in almost every state, a pretty significant drop. And one of the primary reasons that it dropped was in the 1940s and the 1950s, they began to have conversations. People started to talk about the use of mandatory minimum sentences, which had been developed years before that, and how unfair those mandatory minimum sentences were for drug crimes. And the arguments were the same that we hear now, that, you know, these mandatory minimums don't work, they're unfair, all those things. The biggest difference, though, was back in the 50s and the early 60s, the people who were arguing to get rid of those mandatory minimums were arguing because too many white men had been sent to prison because of these mandatory minimums. So they literally, at the federal level, got rid of those mandatory minimums, and a lot of people ended up getting out of prison. And so the prison population was actually going down when we started this war on crime instead of the prison population going up. And then it began to explode and accelerate pretty quickly as we put these new laws into place and more punitive measures. We began to really treat crime in a different way. It became law and order. You know, it was a rhetoric that all politicians use who wanted to be elected, whether they be Republicans, Democrats, whatever. All of them use that law and order kind of language. And a part of it was related to the civil unrest that happened in the 1960s, you know, across the country, ignoring what happened, what caused the civil unrest, which was mainly related to, you know, poverty and feeling oppressed in those communities. They used that as kind of a springboard to say, oh, the country is really dangerous. We need to do something about it. We need to lock these people up. And, of course, it was coded racial language because people knew when people spoke about law and order that they were really talking about black people that were, you know, these people that people considered to be the criminals in the country, and ignoring the fact that in 1970, most of the people in prison in the country were actually white.
Yeah. Well, and as we move into, you know, end of the 70s, early 80s, and we start to see the war on drugs, a lot of people have pointed to that and compared it to what we're dealing with still now, the opioid epidemic, mm-hmm. and how we treated people who were on crack cocaine, mm-hmm. not just people who dealt it, but mm-hmm. People who were just everyday users. Mm-hmm. What did the criminalization of drug addicts look like in the 1980s?
Well, you know, we started to create laws in the 1980s under the Reagan administration with the assistance of Congress to fight a war against drugs. And so, you know, one of the things that happens is that over a long period of time, the federal government has criminalized different drugs. So going back to the early 1900s, they, you know, criminalized cocaine, they criminalized marijuana, criminalized heroin, all these things. And those laws have been on the books for a long time. But what happens in the 1980s is this new form of cocaine comes on the scene. Called crack cocaine. Now, nobody knew anything about crack cocaine as these laws were being written. You know, the first really important law in the war on drugs on the federal level was in 1986, and then there's another one in 1988, and then, of course, the one in 1994. But what happens is we began to put punishments in place. We began to create mandatory minimum sentences. We began to create sentences that are related not to the way that we did it before. So prior to that, people would be arrested and adjudicated and sent to prison, sentenced based on the drugs that they used. But we began to use quantities to determine how long people would go to prison. And so we had these sentencing guidelines that were written based on the quantities of drugs that people were caught with. We created really a law that was very unfair. Even though a majority of people who used crack cocaine and who sold crack cocaine were white, and that's still the case to this day. 66% of lifetime users of crack are white people. But the laws were implemented in such a way that we ignored crack cocaine users in rural communities, in small towns, in white communities. We just ignored them for the most part because we concentrated all of our efforts on central cities like Milwaukee and Chicago and Detroit and places of that nature. And so what ends up happening, we began to send people to prison using mandatory minimums. And what we did was we said, well, powder cocaine and crack cocaine aren't the same. Crack cocaine is way more dangerous. You know, there are all of these stories in Time Magazine and Newsweek about how crack cocaine was, you know, the most dangerous drug ever created. And
to clarify, crack cocaine, it's my understanding, is essentially just you've taken less cocaine generally than you might use, and you've combined it with baking soda or some kind of substance like that and then cooked it?
Basically, the only difference between powder cocaine and crack cocaine is how you ingest it into your body. You're literally buying powder cocaine and you're cooking it. And so generally when people snort cocaine, this is what happens. People snort cocaine, it gets into the membranes in the nose, and it takes about 5-10 minutes for them to get to the brain, for the effect to get to the brain. So you get high. There are receptors in our brain that release a chemical called dopamine, which is known as a pleasure chemical, right? So what cocaine does is it tricks your body into, after the dopamine is released into your brain, it tricks your body into not having it go, this process called reuptake, to not going back into those receptors right away. So it'll stay in your system along. That's what the impact of cocaine does. And so what happens when you cook cocaine with baking soda, you create a smokable form of it. So what happens is people take crack cocaine and they cook it and they ingest the fumes. And what happens is it gets into your lungs right away. It gets in your bloodstream right away and you get high almost immediately when you use crack cocaine. That's the only real difference. It's still cocaine. It's just a different way of ingesting cocaine. And so what happens is the high doesn't last as long. It goes away pretty quickly and people, you know, go into a state of depression right after doing cocaine, whether it's powder cocaine or crack cocaine. You go into this state of depression. So you go on this real high, and then you go on a real low. And what people do is they want to get out of that low right away, so they go back and they do more cocaine, more of the crack cocaine. And the big difference between the two, though, is the price. It's very expensive for people to purchase powder cocaine, but really, really cheap to buy crack cocaine. You know, a drug dealer can go and buy a certain amount of powder cocaine, turn it into thousands and thousands of vials of crack cocaine. And so it becomes this drug that people become very concerned about. It ends up ruining a lot of people's lives, and there are all of these stories about it. People are talking about it as if they're experts on it, and they don't know anything about it because nobody has done any research on it. It just becomes one of these things where enough people say that it's the most addictive drug known to man, then everybody begins to believe it, even though it's absolutely untrue. And so because of that, we began to hear about cocaine more than we had before. And there were two really famous incidents in 1986 that were very unfortunate, but really played a role in this. One was the death of a basketball player, Len Bias. He was a great basketball player at the University of Maryland, was drafted number 2 overall by the Boston Celtics, who had just won the championship that year. And he was going to be this piece to the team that keep them in a championship status for many years. A very, very highly regarded player. People thought he was going to be an outstanding player. He was drafted. He ended up using some powder cocaine and had a heart attack, which is pretty common for people to use cocaine. He had a heart attack and died. Later that summer, a professional football player for the Cleveland Browns, he ended up using cocaine and died of a heart attack as well. And so there was all of this conversation about how dangerous cocaine is. And then people started to blame crack cocaine, even though crack cocaine wasn't what either of these players used. And so it became this groundswell of talk about crack this and crack that. And so it was very easy for people to pass this legislation in 1988, which basically said if you're caught with 5 grams of crack cocaine, there's a mandatory minimum 5-year prison sentence, which is the only mandatory minimum sentence for the first time you're convicted. There is no other drug in the country at that time that required a mandatory minimum sentence for a first-time offender. And you needed 500 grams of powder cocaine to get the same mandatory 5-year sentence. So you literally created a 100-to-1 ratio. And most people were okay with that because they had heard about how dangerous cocaine was, but they thought that crack cocaine was way more dangerous, not understanding that they're the same chemical. And so you began to have a tremendous number of people arrested for crack cocaine offenses, and most of those people arrested were black. Not only were we arresting people who were selling the drugs, but we were also arresting and incarcerating people who were users. And our prisons began to fill up with people who were drug addicts. And, you know, nowadays we've heard, as you mentioned, the opioid crisis and how many people are addicted to opioids. But we don't see this mass arrests of people who are on opioids. Now we're talking about drug treatment for these people. And so we created a situation where we pointed the finger at the black and Latino community in particular, and we put all of our efforts into to fighting drugs in those communities and ignoring it in other communities, particularly the white community. Had we done the same thing in the white communities that we did in the black and Latino communities, I'm sure that white people would have been very upset and would have made sure that those things didn't happen, that they weren't all of these mass arrests of people and people weren't consistently being harassed by the police. Obviously, people were selling drugs, but at the same time, people forget that in the early 80s, prior to this stuff happening, that the economy collapsed, that we had the largest recession since the Great Depression in 1981 and 82, and people were out of work by the millions. The unemployment rate in 1982 reached double digits for the first time since 1941. So there was an economic crisis. People needed to feed themselves. And if this was a way to provide food and shelter for themselves and their families, they were going to take advantage of it. I mean, it's no different than what happened during the Great Depression. People decided, well, listen, if there's no real work, then we'll partake in criminal activity to make money for ourselves. And those things in the 80s in particular began to lead us to have huge disparities in terms of who was in the prisons. I looked at some data, and like I said earlier, 66% of lifetime users of crack cocaine are white, 17% are black. But if you look at our federal prison system, people who are in prison for crack cocaine offenses, 88% of the people in prison for federal crack cocaine sentences are black, and only 4% are white. So there's this huge disparity, which can't be explained by usage. In fact, if we were to go by usage, there would be way more white people in prison for crack cocaine offenses, whether they be users or sellers of it, because the DA tells us that people who buy drugs generally buy drugs from people who look like themselves. So there would be a lot more white people in prison for crack cocaine. But you look at the data and you see that it's an unfair system. And that's what I want to really expose to people. And even if you look at the state prisons, it's a huge disparity. 70% of lifetime drug users in America have been white people, according to data from the federal government. But they make up only about 30% of people who are in prisons for drug crimes in our state prisons. So there's disparity on the federal level. There's huge disparity on the state level as well. And those are things that people are kind of beginning to admit now. President Clinton apologized for being part of this and other people who signed the law in 1994. But nobody has apologized for the laws in 1988 or 1986 or any of the other ones that I talked to you about. Nobody's apologized for those. Those really created the system that we have. And I think what's left out of the conversation about reform that's happening is that, listen, not only do we have 2.2 million people incarcerated on any given day, we also have over 2 million people who work for the criminal justice system on any given day, anywhere from 2.2 to 2.4 million people, depending on the database you look at. So well over 2 million people that are employed as police officers and judges, court clerks, stenographers, prison guards, probation and parole agents. So it's really a system that is self-perpetuating because it employs over 2 million people. To incarcerate 2 million people, we have 2 million people working in the system to make sure that people are incarcerated.
So when we look at reforming this system, what are the ideas out there and what's actually being implemented?
Well, you know, there's a lot of talk about reform, and there have been a great deal of reform efforts by different states. States are doing different things. So states are getting rid of mandatory minimum sentences. States are getting rid of, like, the three strikes and you're out laws. States are changing the sentencing guidelines for, you know, different crimes. So there's a lot that's being done. Even on the federal level, there have been efforts to change, like, the crack cocaine versus powder cocaine sentencing disparity, which is 100 to 1, has been lowered to 18 to 1. There have been measures on the federal level that have kind of allowed people to get out of prison earlier to kind of backtrack on some of those sentences that were developed in the 80s. But I tell people that those things are slow to happen and that they're not having a huge impact. They are having an impact, though. We are seeing less numbers of blacks in prison. The number of blacks, black men in prison in particular, has been dropping since 2002 when it reached its peak. It's been going down every year since then. The national prison population has decreased primarily because of states like California, which the prisons were so overcrowded that federal judges basically forced them to let people out of prison early because it was just ridiculous overcrowding. So there are efforts that are working. You know, the First Step Act, which was passed by Congress early this year, was kind of an extension of some of the same reform that happened under President Obama. But this is what I've been telling people about it, Joy. is that the Democrats and Republicans got together early this year and they celebrated and hugged it up in Congress, saying, look what we've done with the First Step Act. And there are currently over 200,000 people in our federal prison system, right? But if you look at the reforms that were in the First Step Act, first of all, people have to apply to have those reforms apply to them. So to get out early, they have to go through this arduous process to get out. And a lot of people have actually gotten out over the last several months, which is great. However, if everybody who's eligible to get out of prison early under that act were to get out, that would be a total of about 6,600 people out of 200,000. That's not making that much of a difference. On the surface, it looks like it's making a difference. Somewhere in the neighborhood of, I believe, 3,000 people got out sometime over the summer. But what people don't know is many of the people who are getting out, a significant percentage of them, are actually people who are getting out who are undocumented immigrants, and they're being deported as soon as they get out of prison. So they're letting them out of prison. They're telling everybody, look, we're letting people out of prison. And then they're locking them up and deporting them immediately. And we don't hear those stories. Nobody's really telling us that, a lot of people that got out, well, they're shipping them out of the country. So, you know, the reforms are great. There are a lot of efforts here in Wisconsin to talk about reform. There really hasn't been much reform in Wisconsin. There's been reform in a lot of states. A lot of states are, creating best practices that we could follow as a state, but we're choosing not to. And I tell people who are working on the reform efforts that what they don't understand is that they're fighting against a huge system. We don't have a criminal justice system in the United States, Georgia. We literally have over 3,000 criminal justice systems because every county or county equivalent has their own district attorney and their own system in those counties. Then we have the federal system, and then we have the military system as well. So we have all of these different systems that don't always work well together, and reform in one county doesn't apply to the next county. So, for instance, when you're looking at the reforms in the Philadelphia district attorney's office, who says we're not going to charge people with marijuana and we're going to stop doing some of the things that have led to mass incarceration, well, that's great in Philadelphia, in that particular county, but it's not impacting the rest of the state of Pennsylvania. And when you have reforms in one county, it doesn't impact the rest of the states because the counties do whatever they want to do. So really, I've been telling people here in Wisconsin that when we think of the incarceration of people here, and there are over 23,000 people in our prisons currently, the effort to reform the system needs to be a statewide effort, but it also needs to be a countywide effort. We need to look at the counties where a majority of the people are coming from and ask, what's driving it in those communities and fight it at that level. To me, the most hidden part of our criminal justice system in Wisconsin that people aren't aware of is in 1999, we passed Truth in Sentencing Law. And that law changed a lot of things in Wisconsin. So what it did was it got rid of parole. So people are no longer eligible for parole unless they were sentenced prior to that law, becoming a law. And what happens now is when you're convicted in our court system, you get two sentences. You get a sentence of time in prison, and then you get a sentence of supervised extended release once you get out of prison. And it's typically 25% of whatever your prison sentence is. So what happens, people do their time, they get out of prison, and then they are given a list of at least 18 rules they have to follow under their extended supervision. And violations of those 18 rules, and some people get even more rules because the law is written in such a way that probation parole agents can add additional rules to that list at their leisure. I mean, they can just say, we're going to add 5 more rules. So it's really up to the probation parole agents. But what happens is people who violate the terms of their supervised release or are accused of violating those can be put on hold. They're going to be stuck in a Milwaukee secure detention facility while they investigate to determine whether or not they're going to be sent back to prison under what's known as revocation. If you look at the data from the Wisconsin Department of Corrections, they have a great database where you can look up, a variety of things, and they list who goes to prison and why they go to prison. So there are a couple categories. The two main categories of people going to prison in Wisconsin are due to new sentences, so that means you were convicted in court, given a sentence, you go to prison. And then the other major category are revocations. So these are people who are revoked due to violations of the terms of their supervised release. And we literally send more people to prisons for revocations every year practically every year since truth in sentencing was developed, there are only 3 years where we sent more people to prison for new sentences than for revocations. All of the other years, we've sent more people to prison for revocations. So since we created truth in sentencing, we've sent about 48,000 people to prison for new sentences in Wisconsin, but we sent 54,000 people to prison for revocations. And people don't understand these revocations are not people committing new crimes and being sent to prison. These are people who did not commit a new crime. They were not convicted in court. They violated the terms of revocation, or they were accused of violating. And all it takes is someone to call your probation parole agent and say, well, you threatened me, and you have no way of proving that you didn't threaten the person, and they can send you back to prison. And so we are sending more people to prison for revocations than we are for new sentences. It's creating a revolving door in our prison system. You get out, and the chances of you going back are very, very high because you have to deal with being under constant surveillance and following these rules, which are very difficult to not get caught up. And so, to me, the biggest way to reform our prison system in Wisconsin is to stop sending people to prison for revocations, to do what many other jurisdictions are doing, create sanctions for people who violate these things, create, you know, a fine or some other type of sanction, but don't send people to prison. We send people to prison I think there are only three or four states that send people to prison due to violations of, you know, extended supervision at a higher rate than Wisconsin. And as long as we continue to do that, our prison population will continue to grow. And that's something that we need to address as a state because we are wasting billions of dollars having people sitting in prisons who don't deserve to be in prisons and disrupting their lives and their families' lives and their communities. We could do better. We don't need to do some of the things that we're doing. And there are efforts. You know, Evan Goyke has been working on this issue for a number of years. He has submitted several proposals of how to lower the number of people that go back to prisons for revocations, and I applaud that work, but I don't think that it goes far enough. I think that we should really take a much closer look at why people are being revoked. And right now, the data isn't available in terms of, you know, you have the 18 rules or more. There is no database that can show anybody in the state of Wisconsin the specific percentage of people that are going back for violations of rule number one or rule number three or rule number eight. Nobody knows. I've been asking for this data for the last 2 years. Everybody tells me it's not available. And I say, that's nonsense. There is a paper trail. When you are revoked, there is a reason. It's written on a piece of paper somewhere in somebody's computer that you can create a database so that we can see, you know, maybe 17% of people are going back for violating rule number three and 40% are going back for rule number five or whatever. We need that data to determine really what reasons people are going back due to revocations and work on, okay, so if these are the main reasons, if these three, four, five different rules are the main reasons, then we need to kind of adjust what we're doing and offer other alternative sanctions for people who are violating those rules instead of sending them back to prison unnecessarily.
Well, Reggie Jackson, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
You're welcome, Joy.
Reggie Jackson is the head griot for America's Black Holocaust Museum. He's a writer for the Milwaukee Independent and the co-owner of Nurturing Diversity Partners. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers, and he'll give a presentation about the history of mass incarceration tomorrow night at the Shorewood Village Center at 6:30. You can find a link to the event at wuwm.com.